You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. I know that I'm reaching you right now in a very crazy time, and I'm with you. I don't know what's going on. I'm watching the news and scrolling through my phone just like you guys are too, but I'm grateful that it is a time where we can all kind of slow down, spend some time with loved ones that are home with us, and maybe read some great books, listen to some great podcasts, watch some great TV shows, connect with people that we don't necessarily get a chance to talk to all the time. I just talked to my dad today for an hour. Of course, we talked a lot about Irish history, given that St. Patrick's Day is tomorrow. But, you know, it's a good time to just slow down and just kind of connect with each other. So if you are watching TV, I've got two great shows for you in this episode. One is called Formula One, Drive to Survive, which is on Netflix, and another is called McMillions, which is on HBO. Both are fantastic shows, and I really recommend it also for couples. I know that while you're home this week and the kids finally go to bed, or you know, you're just starting to date somebody and you're living together or whatever, and you're looking for something to kind of both watch and talk about, these are two great shows for you. So the first one is called Formula One Drive to Survive, again, on Netflix. So the drivers, managers, and team owners in Formula One live life in the fast lane, both on and off the track. And this docuseries gives viewers exclusive, really intimate access to the people in one of the world's greatest racing competitions. I knew jack squat about Formula One. I stumbled across this show, and I have to tell you, I got sucked in quick. I'm totally fascinated by this business now. I love shows that kind of peel back the layer in a world that I don't know anything about, and this is personifies that. So Formula One, Drive to Survive, reveals the true story of this high-octane sport, which goes beyond just the fight to be number one. There's also a battle for the heart, soul, and direction of the multi-billion dollar business. Storylines include changes that a team undergoes after an ownership change and the pressure felt to outperform other drivers. They follow some incredible drivers. You kind of get to go home with them and to see their extended family. For one of the racers, he is a second generation. He shows us his family in Spain. His cousin is his manager. So there are all these great personal stories that are tied into it. It's sort of like Hard Knocks on HBO, which is for the football industry, American football. This is kind of like their version. And I have to say, you're going to walk away feeling kind of emboldened by this knowledge about this incredible sport and touched by some of the personal stories. You're going to find yourself wanting to follow them on Instagram. I'm telling you, it's a great show for couples. If you've got boys at home that are really into car racing, I was actually thinking about my son in his kindergarten yearbook. The boy said what they wanted to be. And I, now that I think back to it, my son had said soldier, but there were like three boys that wrote Formula One race car drivers. And I kind of just didn't even think about it. But now in retrospect, I'm like, totally get it. These are really incredible athletes. And I was really interested in the workouts that they have to do because they have to have the best hand-eye coordination of any athlete. And then I had no idea, but Lewis Hamilton, who's one of the drivers, he is the highest paid athlete in the entire world, apparently. So it's a great show. And I asked Travis Clark, Executive Vice President of Action Sports at Wasserman Media Group, to kind of give me insight into this world. He loves the show too. So if you're like, I don't know, I'm not totally into this yet, I don't know, he is going to kind of give you the lay of the land so you can start watching it. Now, the other show I'm crazy about is a 6-part documentary series from executive producer Mark Wahlberg. McMillions chronicles the stranger-than-fiction true story of how $24 million was stolen from McDonald's Monopoly game of the 1990s. The mystery mastermind behind the scam and the intrepid FBI agents on his trail. I'm sure all of you have at some point played that Monopoly game. I used to babysit for a family and they were so crazy about that stupid game. I'm like, I have to go out and get you like how many Happy Meals to get you some points. Well, it turns out all these people had been playing and there was no chance that they were going to win. So for over a decade, McDonald's fast food empire awarded prizes in its Monopoly promotional game tie-in, unaware that the biggest winning tickets were being stolen and sold to undeserving winners through a complex web of family and friends who became co-conspirators. So McDonald's had no idea that this had been going on. So an anonymous tip to the FBI in 2001 triggers a far-reaching chain of events that will come to include dogged and unorthodox investigative work, undercover sting operations, and dirty dealings by shifty ex-cons with ties to the mafia. It's like a movie. It's insane. So the series unravels the twisted threads of the fast food fraud through exclusive first-hand accounts and archival footage, which is incredible, featuring the FBI agents who brought down the gaming scam, McDonald's corporate executives who were themselves defrauded, the lawyers who tried the case, and the culprits and prize winners who profited from the complicated scheme, as well as individuals who were often unwittingly duped into being part of the ruse. This is a production done by HBO and Unrealistic Ideas Productions, and one of their producers of McMillions is Archie Gibbs, and I was so thrilled that I got a chance to talk to him this week about how this project came together, how it was filmed, etc. If you are watching, wondering, what can I watch that plays out like a thriller, you're going to be sucked into this. It is 6 parts and you will enjoy every single episode. And I'm telling you, the cast of characters in this are bar none the best that I've seen in a long time. So 2 shows this week I want you to watch: Netflix's Formula One Drive to Survive and HBO's McMillions. So my interview exclusives this week are with the producer, Archie, of McMillions. And I'm starting off with Travis Clark about Formula One Drive to Survive. So here we go. McMillions is a spectacular 6-part documentary series on HBO, which chronicles the stranger-than-fiction true story of how $24 million was stolen from the McDonald's Monopoly game of the 1990s, the mystery mastermind behind the scam, and the intrepid FBI agents on his trail. The series is executive produced by Unrealistic Ideas' Mark Wahlberg, Stephen Levinson, and Archie Gibbs. I'm thrilled to have Emmy-nominated producer Archie Gibbs with me today. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Kate. Thanks for having me.
This is so good. I have mentioned this to so many people. I am pretty confident that this is one of the best documentaries that people can watch in the last 2 years. Please tell me how this project came about.
Yeah, well, basically, there was an article that was written in the Daily Beast a couple of years ago, which was all about the McDonald's Monopoly game. It caused quite a stir in Hollywood, and a lot of people were interested in it. It turns out that you know, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck were on board, and they sold it to Fox as a feature film. I was actually interested in acquiring it, the non-scripted version of it. A friend of mine was a producer on that project, so I was about to reach out to him, I was texting him. And while I was texting him, a buddy of mine, Brian Lazarte, texted me and said, have you read this article? And of course, it was the Daily Beast article. And I said, yes, I had. In fact, I was about to reach out to my friend. Brian said, don't reach out to him. My buddy James and I are going to come to your office tomorrow. So Brian and James had been working with the FBI for a couple of years. James actually had put in a FOIA request, I believe in 2012. It took him about 3 or 4 years to finally get that request. And he and Brian started interviewing some of the FBI people, specifically Chris Graham was one of the first people they met with. And essentially what happened was they had put together a documentary about this, and they felt like they were trumped by this announcement of the film with Ben Affleck and Damon. And so they came to us and we saw the material, which they had incredible archival material from the FBI. And both these guys are extremely talented editors. They cut together an incredible sizzle piece. And we were like, oh my God, this is gold. So I basically told them, you are not leaving our office until we come up with a deal to partner with you guys. And they obviously understood the, you know, what Mark Wahlberg and Steven Levinson would bring to the table, along with my background in documentary film. Brian and I are longtime friends. We've worked together in the past on the Katy Perry movie, documentary film. And so we obviously had a great relationship. And so we promised them, we said, look, if you guys come on board, we'll make this story the way that you want to tell it. And so we pitched it to HBO. HBO loved it. They didn't want the guys to direct it at first because they didn't really have a track record of directing. But Mark, Steven, and myself basically were like, no, these are the guys for the job. And sure enough, once HBO really met them and talked with Brian and James, they understood how well they knew the story, how great storytellers they were. And so it just went from there. We got HBO behind it, and the guys went back into the field and started interviewing not only the rest of the FBI members, but also all of the quote unquote prize winners.
How were you able to convince this extraordinary cast of characters to become involved?
It was two things. Number one is, again, the directors, Brian and James, they had built up an incredible relationship with the FBI, with the few members that they had met. And so it was quite easy once word of mouth came that, like, hey, you should trust these guys. Then once we have the Mark Wahlberg factor, Mark is always the key to these things because, you know, we have such an excellent reputation, Mark's career, you know, in Hollywood film, along with Lev, you know, people really trust us to tell the story in a way that's going to be accurate and you know, true. So I think those two things really helped. I knew when the guys went back out and told, you know, the FBI and also some of the prize winners that they'd partnered up with Mark Wahlberg's production company, Unrealistic Ideas, they felt a lot better about it. And so a lot of people decided to hop on board. But really it was also, again, just to reiterate, you know, Brian and James building these relationships with these people and gaining their trust was very important.
Was it more difficult to gain that trust with the executives at McDonald's?
That's a great point you bring up. By far the hardest people to get on board was not the criminals, was not the FBI, it was the McDonald's. McDonald's, literally, I'd say they did not agree to come on board into the project. And that, again, was, we had a conference call. Actually, Brian and James flew out to Chicago to McDonald's headquarters. I was on video conference with them. And one of the first things that they said when we hopped on the call was, Archie, is this just some ploy of Mark Wahlberg to get back at McDonald's because of Wahlberg?
I was going to ask that. Not the case.
But we did say that, look, we want to tell this story. We're going to tell this story. And, you know, with or without you. So why not be a part of it? Tell your story. You know, so everyone kind of got it, especially because if you watch the series, you know, McDonald's obviously comes across looking very good because they did take that chance to go out, even though they knew that it was rigged. They allow the FBI to do it one more time so they could try to catch their man.
Oh, I think they came off great in the end. What was the part that made up most of the process, the research or the filming?
It was, I would say both. I mean, we really had an incredible team on board. There was an incredible team of producers that did a lot of the archival research, some of the amazing footage you see in there. They spent a lot of time pulling that out. And of course, Brian and James and our crew in the field, just traveling all throughout Southeast United States, Jacksonville, South Carolina, Southern Florida and Miami area, Atlanta, Georgia. A lot of it took place on the, Southeast. And so they were out there for months filming. But then, of course, a ton of the time was spent after we got all the interviews in the can, shooting a lot of the recreations. And a lot of that was done back in California and other various places. And again, with the approval of McDonald's, once McDonald's came on board, it was great because they actually allowed us to film in a real McDonald's. We obviously made it look a little more 90s, but it was pretty cool.
Doug Matthews, first of all, such a character. He's still an active agent. How were you able to get access to him? Did you have to jump through hoops to get access to him?
Well, it's funny because Brian and James, one of the things when James first approached the FBI, they said to him, "Oh my gosh, like this is one of our favorite cases ever that no one's ever talked to us about. Like we don't know why no one's ever come to us." So they were chomping at the bit to tell this tale. And you're right that, Doug is one of the only people that we interviewed that is actually still an active member of the FBI. But he was, the FBI gave him approval to talk, and now we know why, because the guy is a gift for gab. Mm-hmm. And I just based on the reaction on social media, I would say, 85% of the people absolutely adore him and love him. And there's 15% that just despise him, which I guess is always a good thing to have some people hating you too, is always, creates a good dynamic.
Well, didn't you say that he would call you guys like even at like 11:30 at night and just talk for like an hour and a half?
Yeah, everyone was so excited about this case, because the thing that's really interesting is the FBI only knew so much about the case. They only did just enough to find their people in order to make the arrest. And what I mean by that is, Brian and James did such a deep dive with all of our team, the producing team. They found out tons of information that the FBI had no idea about. So when McMillions aired, we would get phone calls, and Chris Graham, actually, who's I've met several times, become somewhat of a friend of mine. He would, we would be talking, and be like, "I cannot believe how much stuff you guys, found out that we had no idea." Oh. So everyone was like just blown away by the amount of material that Brian and James and the team put together.
So then I understand that you guys are going to do something else with him. That he was such a character that you want to do another project with him.
Yes. Cannot go too in depth because it's all still in the, obviously in the works, but we are doing Unrisk Ideas has a podcast division. So we are doing a podcast with Doug. We also are planning to do a non-scripted show with Doug, and we are planning to do a scripted show with Doug. Again, can't go too much into it, but you could probably imagine what those things would be.
What do you think that he is the person that was responsible for the facts?
Off the record, which is now on the record, I would say yes, he is. No one will ever own up to it, but I would have to imagine that Doug was the guy.
Okay, so although the FBI investigation brought multiple indictments, September 10th, 2001, obviously the terrorist attacks the following day virtually erased them from news coverage. Is this the reason that so many people never really knew about what had transpired?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Once 9/11 happened, no one cared about this. Is such a trivial thing. No one could care less. And the one thing that, kind of I don't want to say annoys me, but it kind of disturbs me, is that, you know, these guys were the white collar division of the FBI in Jacksonville. So a lot of people are like, why weren't they looking after, you know, going after the terrorists down in Florida, you know, while this was happening? Because these guys, these FBI agents were not assigned to that. They were only assigned to the white collar stuff. So once obviously 9/11 happened, the agents, most of the agents, even the white collar agents, were shifted now to terrorism. But before that, there was no mandate for them to do that. But absolutely, the reason why no one remembers this at all is because of 9/11. It just dropped off the map completely. It became obviously, you know, back page news, if no news at all.
And a vast majority of these winners were seemingly great people. Like Gloria Brown seems wonderful. I love that she's friends with Robin. Which of the winner stories was the most compelling for you?
Well, I would say, I mean, George Chandler to me is incredible. Yeah. I mean, just because he just got completely hoodwinked and he had no idea. And he's such a solid guy. But again, with me, it would be Gloria Brown. I had the absolute privilege of sitting next to Gloria. We premiered at Sundance this year, and we premiered the first three episodes, and Gloria was out there. She came out to see it for the very first time. She had not seen it at all. We asked her if she would like to see it in advance, obviously, so she could deal with her emotions and whatnot. And she said, no, I just want to watch this with the audience. I don't want to see it in advance. So I actually sat next to Gloria in the movie theater with like 500 people watching this. And her energy, her nervous energy sitting next to her was so palpable. And I would, you know, kind of hold her hand during the middle of it and stuff because she was so overwhelmed by it. But in the end, it was so cathartic. And she was so happy that her story could be told and that people understood why she did what she did. She certainly is not proud of what she did, but she, you know, she's very pleased that she was able to get it out there and people are able to relate with her, that they too might have made that same, you know, that same choice in her position.
McMillions is kind of atypical too, because it's atypical to the true crime genre because it's got so much levity to it. Had you set out to do that, or was the material so zany that you kind of just leaned into it?
The characters were absolutely gift wrapped to us. I mean, there's no denying that. I mean, between, you know, Doug Matthews is incredible. Robin Columbo is an incredible character. Mm-hmm. H.A. Glum is an incredible character. These are like, they're like out of central casting practically.
Yeah.
So it definitely lent itself. And then in the edit, you know, Brian and James are both, and myself, we obviously all love comedy to begin with, but I think we really, once we saw Doug and realized what he was giving us, it was like, okay, we need to shape this in a way that it's absurd. First of all, the whole thing is absurd, right? Even going into it, the great thing, no one got murdered. No one's really, you know, really harmed in a huge way. Obviously people lost their jobs, which is a terrible thing, which we get to later on, but like no one was killed. And the fact that this is an absurd thing. We just totally leaned into the absurdity of it all. And again, that was really Brian and James and Jody, the lead editor on the project, did a fantastic job in leaning into that comedy. And then, of course, the amazing music score that we have, which is sort of that Ocean's 11 type, you know, mad caper, gives it a mad caper feel to it.
Now, so it also involves the Columbo family, this notorious mob family. Are you kicking yourself that you found out about Ma Columbo after you had filmed that family party?
Are we kicking ourselves? No, we're not. Because Ma Columbo, we asked to go, you know, we did ask to interview her, but she declined to be interviewed. And again, Frank, you know, basically had to get permission from Ma to even say he could, you know, for him to actually reveal that she was the one that was the informant, because he didn't want to do anything that would, you know, not be cruel with her. So, but it was that entire Columbo family is obviously incredibly captivating. Let's put it that way.
Exactly.
And I think that, again, just going off of social media, I just get such a kick out of like going through Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and so forth. The number one comment by far is, you know, Frank's order of, you know, 10 creams and 5 sugars at McDonald's.
I know. I mean,
it's just crazy.
Well, Frank and Heather are quite a pair. I mean, they're just hilarious. And they seem like they have no idea how funny they are. Are any of the other, like, ancillary relatives mad at them for divulging so many secrets?
I don't think so. I mean, it's just, you know, they're such a kooky couple. I mean, they're hilarious. I've met Frank. I haven't had the pleasure of meeting Heather. I bet I would, you know, think she's the best if I met her. But Frank is just the nicest guy in the world. And, you know, just really kind of oddly proud of his brother and everything he accomplished. And, you know, he's Frank, and again, another little tease, but Frank, we are also potentially developing a show with Frank.
So. I mean, he's totally television gold. And then when his son comes in and he has the McDonald's uniform on, and like, you could not make this stuff up. It seemed just to be like a hilarious, bizarre moment that obviously was not scripted.
No, I actually, and this is the thing, when the guys showed me that, because they would call me up, they would be out in, on the road, obviously, and it'd be like 2 a.m. on the East Coast. They'd call me back here in L.A. at 11 p.m. and they'd be like, dude, you're not going to believe what happened in this interview. You're not going to believe. Every night they would be giving me the download of what happened. I'd be like, oh my God, this is insanity. And we would like be like giddy almost with all the stuff they were capturing. And when I finally saw that, you know, Frank's son come in the McDonald's uniform, I was like, Haley said, we might not be able to use this. And like, what are you talking about? Like, because people will think we set this up. It's so absurdly crazy. And we're like, you know what? It's real. Let people think it's fake if they think it's fake. But that is 100% real.
I can imagine that, getting the field calls like you would not believe. For example, when Robin falls in the graveyard, did they call you and say, you are not going to believe what happened today?
Yes, they did. They called me when that happened. They called. They also, the other thing that we would talk about, because we did not know who the informant was. And so every call practically was like, okay, who do you think the informant was? And when they heard from Lee, so Lee was the sort of the friend, quote unquote friend of Jerry Colombo, who was the airline stewardess. And we thought for the longest time that she really was the informant. And then it moved along to a couple other people that we thought that was informant. So when we found out definitively, when they interviewed Frank and they, you know, kind of gave up that Ma Colombo was the informant, they called me immediately. They're like, dude, we have our final episode. Like, this is insane. Like, they were blown away by it. And the thing that I really love about the project and what James and Brian did so masterfully is it goes between like funny and like more serious, just kind of seamlessly. And, you know, having those 6 episodes, it allows us to do deep dives into these characters. You get to know them. Mm-hmm. I know some, you know, reading online, some people are like, oh, it should have just been a 2-hour doc.
Well, you guys are
missing the point. You know, you're missing the point. This is like, where it's almost like watching a scripted TV show, allowing you into the lives of these characters and getting an idea of who they are and why they did the things they did, you know?
And you have such empathy for all of them by the end of it. You really get to know enough about them that it's kind of nice at the end that you feel good about them, and that they also seem to have made peace with what happened. I mean, some of them have friendships, which are very unlikely friendships. Did you get a sense that most of these people have made peace with what happened?
I absolutely do. Obviously more, you know, some than others. I do think that George Chandler still struggles with it quite a bit, even though obviously he and Dwight have, you know, somewhat repaired the relationship. But I think, you know, George was such a successful businessman. And then even to this day, he, you know, I think he'll never fully recover from it, because he truly was, out of all the people, I mean, he had no idea whatsoever. And so I do think there's a little residual with him. But yeah, I mean, Gloria, I think they all, this was such a cathartic thing for them to have this put out and really tell their story in a way so people can understand and people can relate. I mean, the thing is this, we always said, you know, even when we started the project, it was like, if you had a chance to win $1 million and someone said, just say you won it. I mean, mm-hmm. so many people go, I would never do that. But really, you would think long and hard about it, you know. And so I think it's such an easy sort of crime that people would consider that it's very relatable. And obviously, you can understand why these people might have done it and feel for them, you know, that they made a mistake.
And so many people had played the game, so it wasn't totally unfamiliar to them. And it's this major company that's part of American life, that it had the makings of just a great, great story. My last question is, what about Jerry Jacobson? I'm sure you asked him a million times to come forward and do an interview. Obviously, he didn't. Where does that stand?
Well, let me just jump in one thing with you. You made an amazing point, Kate. I just wanted to kind of, you know, tag on to that, is the fact that so many people played that McDonald's Monopoly game in their youth, you know, growing up. And that's why I think McMillions resonates with people, because you watch a lot of true crimes. Like, you're totally distant from it. You're like, mm-hmm. oh, this happened. This person was put away. You know, this person murdered. I mean, it's riveting stuff, but you weren't directly affected by it. So many people played that game and thought they could win, and they're directly affected by it. So you actually have a rooting interest in this thing from the get-go, which I think what makes it very special. But going back to your Jerry, you know, Jacobson, Uncle Jerry, we went back and forth with him for a long time. The guys did an amazing job of trying to get him on camera. They spoke to his wife several times. They spoke on the phone to Jerry several times. Again, it was always saying to him, look, we're telling this story. We want you to be able to
tell your story,
defend yourself, tell your story, right? Because there's people that are saying things that are not so nice about you. So you should probably tell your own story so you can get it out there. And he never wanted to do it. He felt that he was, I guess, ashamed and embarrassed of what he had done and did not want to go on camera. So that was it. So we, you know, you never know. There might be down the line a very special episode of McMillions down the road. Uncle Jerry speaks. That's always
amazing.
Sort of a possibility. But
well, knowing you guys, you might have some project with them in the future. You never know.
You never know. You never know.
And I also loved Mark Devereaux. I mean, is that guy a stud or what?
Oh my gosh. Mark Devereaux never met a microphone that he didn't love speaking into. He also was at Sundance with us. And that guy is just, I mean, he's an actor that happens to be a lawyer,
right?
You know, and a very good lawyer, obviously, incredible attorney. But the guy just loves, you know, loves telling jokes and loves sort of being bombastic and, he's a great character. And again, there's so many characters in this project that it was just a delight.
Where it was a little part of you sad when it all ended, because I think we can all relate to that feeling, that giddy feeling of like, I don't know what else is going to happen in this project, but it just keeps getting better and better. Was there a part of you that was bummed when it all ended?
Absolutely. I wanted it to be like 10 episodes. I'm like, let's milk it out. No, I didn't want. We always say that the content is going to dictate how long, you know, a project is. And with this, we really felt that 6 was the perfect number, just because we wanted to tell everyone's stories. We wanted to be wrapped up in a way that, you know, felt satisfying. That's not to say that we're not going to do other projects about other things that are crazy in the vein of McMillions as a follow-up. But certainly it was the Brian and James, they joke that they're sort of, you know, now it's like a postpartum situation for them, but they don't know what to do with themselves once the series ended. But we actually are working with them on another project, which will be announced very soon. So we're very excited about that.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah. Well, tell us what else you're working on right now.
So we have a ton of stuff that is in the works. A lot of things are in development, so I can't really talk to you too much about that. But of course, there's a project coming out on Quibi. Your listeners, Quibi is,
of course,
coming out in April, I believe April 6th. So we have a project on Quibi that is a documentary film called Run This City, which is an incredible story. It's almost as mind-blowing as McMillions, but obviously on a much smaller level. The mayor of Fall River was the youngest mayor ever, Fall River. And it was the way when we started the project, it basically was sort of Entourage meets the mayor's office. So this young mayor who hired a bunch of his friends to be on his cabinet and so forth. And in the middle of us filming and being with him, he actually got indicted by the FBI.
Oh, man.
And so the project basically follows, his name is Jaisal Carrera, and he's an amazing dynamic character. And his fight for, you know, proving his innocence is pretty compelling. So that's on Quibi, called Run the City. And then we also have another project which we're filming right now. It'll be on HBO Max. The premiere date's not set yet. It'll be sometime later this year, which is called Wall Street, W-A-H-L, Street, which is all about Mark Wahlberg's life in film and TV and his businesses. So think real-life Entourage with Mark Wahlberg.
That sounds great.
And then we have another incredible project. Two projects are coming out for Discovery Channel. I can't really get into that. Still a little top secret, but and lastly, we have a podcast division, as I mentioned earlier, and we have several podcasts coming out. Of course, right now we have the McMillions podcast, which is out. And if any of your listeners have seen McMillions and are jonesing for more, you should definitely check out the podcast, because there's a ton of information and deleted scenes and so forth that's in that is not in the TV series. Plus there's interviews with all of the major players too. Mark Devereaux, Chris Graham, Robin Columbo, Gloria Brown, and AJ Glum.
Well, that's what I'm going to be listening today when I take the kids on a walk. I can't even tell you how much I enjoyed talking with you, and McMillions is fantastic. Super excited for all the other stuff that's coming our way from Unrealistic Ideas, and can't thank you enough. How can people follow you personally?
Well, they can't, because my wife won't let them. No, I'm kidding. My stuff is on private because I have two little kids, but you could definitely follow Unrealistic Ideas, and which is Unrealistic_Ideas, I believe, or dash, I'm not even sure. But Unrealistic Ideas on Instagram is the best way to follow us. And I believe we also are on LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter as well. But and then you can keep up to date with all the projects. We do have some really cool projects coming up, and we'd love to talk to you about those in the future, Kate.
So tell me a little bit about the world of Formula One. This is big, big money. So I guess that professional football is worth, what, $8 billion? Formula One's worth $2 billion?
I mean, yeah, this is the pinnacle of all motorsports globally. It's been the number one kind of destination for most drivers from its inception. It's the cutting edge of technology and racecraft, and it's big business. Yeah, I mean, Mercedes is allegedly spending, $500-600 million a year managing their team, and so when you compare that to other sports, it dwarfs most anything else you can kind of compare it to.
So how does this compare to NASCAR? Because I think a lot of Americans particularly are just familiar with NASCAR. So how does this differ from that?
So I guess, the biggest difference is from a technology standpoint. Formula One has no rules. I shouldn't say the no rules. I mean, they have some constraints, but up until this year, it's been unlimited budgets, unlimited thinking. And it's really been the catalyst for manufacturers to test out new ideas and new, products before they make their way to consumers and on their production vehicles. Whereas NASCAR is very much confined to, here are the rules, don't step outside the box, And a lot of what you see on a cup car, you know, isn't found on any of the, you know, production vehicles that the manufacturers make. It's very different from a production standpoint. Formula One is as creative as you can be, go for it. NASCAR, they kind of hinder that creativity.
What makes up the largest population of Formula One viewers or, you know, fans?
Its home base is Europe, and Europe's been where it's kind of it's where it's based. It's where it's kind of grown from. Huge following in Asia. They really gravitate towards it. Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, obviously, they put up big money to attract the races. But it's been growing quickly in the United States over the last couple of years. It's actually the fastest growing form of motorsports in the U.S. from an 18 to 34 perspective demographic. And it's really because of the shows like Netflix. They've connected with new viewers, and they've invested a lot of money in creating events and awareness of the series. You know, our company, Wasserman, has put on two different productions, one in Miami and one just recently in Los Angeles, where we brought out Formula One vehicles, the drivers. We closed down Hollywood Boulevard in January, I think it was. And, you know, we ran the cars down the street a couple blocks. And, you know, they've just really invested in trying to connect and make a conscious effort to reach out and show their product to fans here in the U.S. And so it's actually resonating quite well. They spent a bunch of money building that track in Austin, which is one of the best on the circuit. And they've done a really good job attracting celebrities and kind of incubating their product here, and it's resonated. They've had a global following for a long time, but really try to make inroads here in the U.S. the last couple of years.
What is the profile of a racer?
Young, typically, you know, they start, you know, Lewis Hamilton, who's the sixth-time champion. He started racing go-karts at four. So these guys start young. They're typically, you know, anywhere from 18 when they first get into Formula One. And that was Max Verstappen, who, if you follow season one, you know, set the record for the youngest winner. Up until, you know, 30, mid-30s, typically past that, they're not quite as competitive. It's very much about hand-eye coordination and reaction times. So that, you know, typical athlete 20s, in their 20s is when they're probably at their peak, you know, early 30s. Some guys have, you know, made it longer, but it seems to get younger and younger, and they're developing talent younger and younger.
And how fit do you have to be? Because we see on the show, there's a lot of exercises having to do with hand-eye coordination. They all look pretty fit. Do you have to be quite lean to be a successful racer?
Absolutely. I mean, motorsport is kind of one of the last venues of sport where athletes have really started taking training seriously. I mean, you've probably seen or, you know, heard of the old days of NASCAR and drinking beer and, you know, partying, and that's all gone. I mean, these guys are serious athletes. They're training, they're figuring out ways to improve their hand-eye coordination. They're staying fit. You know, obviously the lighter the athlete is, the less weight that brings to a vehicle, so ideally the faster the car can go. So they're on strict diets, they have professional trainers, and they've really, really pushed the envelope of how to translate from being an athlete into, you know, driving a car, which kind of doesn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people, but now it's paramount to success. And you see the guys that work their butts off and have success, and it's really kind of been a last, you know, 10-15 years where you've seen that transition from, hey, I'm a race car driver, I don't need to be an athlete in terms of training, to I need to train just as hard on myself as we do the team with the vehicle.
How long is a race?
A race is a certain number of laps. They each track is different from a mileage standpoint. They're typically 2+ miles is a track, and they usually will race, I think it's 57 laps or 58 laps for a GP. So however long the track is and however many laps, how long it takes to do a lap is how long they are. Typically, you know, an hour and a half-ish is what a race lasts.
So forget going to the bathroom and forget eating.
No.
Yeah, like that's just not going to happen.
No, but I'll let you know a little secret. When you have athletes who do long distance endurance racing, like a Baja 1000 or a 24-hour Le Mans, they actually do wear catheters.
Oh.
And they pee down a tube that comes out the bottom of their driving suit. a lot of people wonder, how do you guys go to the bathroom in your car that long? And that's the grand secret. And I'll tell you, it's very hard to pee when you're racing at 200 miles an hour.
Listen, I can't even drive past 60 without like shaking. Jeez.
Yeah. Takes talent. Takes talent. That's for sure. More ways than one.
So what is the takeaway? What do you want people to take away from the show? What is it that they're missing? If they've never watched Formula One, what do you think is the most interesting aspect of this sport?
I think the most interesting thing about the show, and obviously being an agent, you know, we live behind the curtain quite a bit, and it's the access that they grant on Netflix. So, you know, the things that you're seeing on the driver negotiations, with the teams and the contract negotiations, and, you know, the revolving musical chairs that they talk about in season two of who's going where when whose contract's up. I mean, that's typically not stuff that's discussed. And I think part of the show's success is how much they pull back the curtain and let people see what goes on behind the curtain, because you don't usually get that level of exposure and access. And it's obviously resonated really well. And I think that's why people who aren't necessarily a fan of Formula One have enjoyed it, because there's drama and the drama's real. And the drama's talking about how this is a big business and how there's sponsors on the line and sponsors are paying. And you saw that in season two. One of the sponsors pulling out because the performance of the vehicle wasn't there, and you're living what the team is going through and how that affects from a budget standpoint how they can compete, and I think that just adds a whole another layer to the visually seeing the racing. Now you're seeing visually what's going on behind the racing, and I think that's really unique and why it's been successful. You know, the other thing I think the takeaway is, and we kind of talked about this, these guys are athletes. A lot of times people think, oh, you drive a car, you don't need to be in shape or you don't need to train. But these are athletes. These guys put in just as much work on themselves as they do with the team on the vehicle. And you see that. And you know, Red Bull has a world-class testing facility that they test all of their athletes. And Red Bull works with athletes across the spectrum of sports. And they have found that Formula One drivers have the quickest reaction times and are able to process information faster than any athletes they've ever tested. So it's just a real, real unique aspect of being a Formula One driver. And I think that's something that people should really pay attention to and appreciate these athletes for.
The people that work for Formula One, what's the college degree that they get? Is it electrical engineering?
It's mechanical engineering. But that, you know, encompasses quite a bit. You know, there's carbon engineers, because all those cars and those are actually carbon tubs that the cars are built around, and, you know, mechanical engineering, how you put all the pieces together. You know, most of it is just some sort of varying degrees of engineering. But you'd be surprised. I mean, a lot of motorsport crew chiefs and crew members, they've got into it because they started sweeping the shop floor. And then they started, you know, taking apart this, and they started putting this back together. And that's how they learn in real life applications. Obviously, those who are designing the cars and stuff have more formal training, but you'd be surprised. A lot of guys, you know, are working for the team and gals, I should say, because they've been there that long. And they started at the bottom and they've just kind of learned as they've been taught. Formula One is quite unique in the size and scope of those teams and the fact they have full manufacturer support. So Mercedes, you know, owns and operates that team. It's a subsidiary of Mercedes, but that is a Mercedes division, of a division of Mercedes that's building those cars for Lewis Hamilton. And, you know, there's a whole team of folks outside of just the engineering that help make the teams go by, from press people to marketing people to sales people to find sponsorships. You know, it's not just engineers that work on the teams. It's a full microcosm of the broader economy from job perspective.
So interesting. Well, thank you so much. How can people kind of follow you and follow what Wasserman is working on?
You can always check out our website, which is www.teamwas.com. We work in a number of areas of sports. We have 2,000 athletes across the globe. So if you watch it, we probably work in it. And then if anyone wants to follow me, which I have no idea why they would, but my Instagram is Clark, that's TCCLARKEEE.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate having me on and spreading the good word of motorsports and Formula One in particular. looking forward to season three already, since I'm a few episodes ahead of you. And season three should be really, really interesting because there's been a lot of changes to the actual series this year in 2020 that you'll see rolled out and played out in the next episode of season three.
The amazing Kate Casey. I want to thank my great guests this week, Travis Clark and Archie Gipps. And I'm wishing you guys all a great week. Of course, I'll have another episode up on Friday. I'm thinking about you. If you want to jump in the Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey, you know, we're talking all week about great books and great podcasts and great movies and great TV shows that will hopefully keep you a little bit distracted this week. I know it's hard not to just watch CNN all day long, but we're all strong. We're all going to make it through. And I'm sending my very best to you and to your loved ones. In the meantime, if you're on Twitter this week and you're scrolling through stuff, I can be found at Kate Casey. And my Instagram is at Kate Casey CA. You can see me try to homeschool 4.5 children while my husband is working in the house, which is a GD nightmare. Basically, we're a reality show, but everyone's house right now is a reality show, right? So again, wishing you all well, and I'm sending you my very best, and just know that you're not alone, and we got this, and we're all together in this, and I love you all.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.